On June 1, 2025, fire exploded across Pearl Street Mall in Boulder, Colorado. 16 injured. A man with a flamethrower. A city silenced. But this wasn't just a hate crime. It was a test. I'm investigative journalist Natalie Reyes, and what I uncovered points to a chilling truth. The attack was part of a federally sanctioned simulation, fueled by predictive algorithms, scrubbed from police watch lists and erased from public record. The system didn't fail. It functioned exactly as designed. This is the story of how surveillance, silence, and simulation collided in plain sight, and the terrifying future it reveals. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The first spark. I got the alert on my phone at 3:14 p.m. I was in D.C., waiting for a source who never showed, sipping burnt coffee in a barely functioning newsroom. The headline read, "Breaking, multiple injured in Boulder firebomb attack." At first, I thought it was clickbait, but then the footage started pouring in. A young woman on Telegram live-streamed from the scene, screaming, smoke everywhere, the lens catching a man in black tactical gear throwing a bottle engulfed in flames. Another clip showed a fireball igniting outside a Patagonia storefront, right in the middle of Pearl Street Mall. You could hear the sound of children crying, glass shattering, people yelling for help. This wasn't a riot. It was a targeted act of terror. Within hours, hashtag BoulderAttack was trending across X and YouTube. But what pulled me in wasn't just the horror. It was the silence from official sources. No suspect named. No motive mentioned. No federal response. Just a brief from the Boulder Police Department that read like an automated PR draft. An isolated incident involving incendiary devices is under investigation. We urge the public to remain calm. Isolated incident? There were 16 confirmed injuries. And it happened at a pro-Palestine march titled Run for Their Lives, an event that had already received online threats in the days leading up to it. So I booked a red eye. I landed in Denver at 11:40 a.m. the next morning. By noon, I was driving north on Highway 36 with nothing but a burner phone, my press ID, and a hard drive full of encrypted case files from past investigations, and a gnawing feeling in my chest that this was going to get ugly. Boulder was quiet when I arrived. Too quiet. Police tape still danced along the edges of the pedestrian mall. The scent of scorched wood and melted plastic lingered near Lindsay's bookshop. The windows of Amante Coffee had been blown out. There were charred pamphlets scattered across the bricks, still readable under the ash. One read, "Stop funding apartheid." It didn't take long to find the first eyewitness. Her name was Mariam. She was 19, a University of Colorado student and co-organizer of the march. Her wrist was wrapped in gauze, her voice calm but clipped, like she hadn't had time to process anything. She told me the attack began without warning. "He came from the west side, just past the courthouse. Walked up like he was part of us. Then he lit the first bottle and threw it into the middle of the crowd." I asked if she recognized him. She didn't, but she remembered his eyes. Dead, like he was already somewhere else. Bystanders captured him clearly. He wasn't wearing a mask, which meant he didn't care if he was caught, or he didn't think he would be. I reviewed over 17 separate videos that afternoon. I triangulated his path. Entry at the southwest corridor. Escape through the alley behind the kitchen supply store. But what disturbed me most was the timing. Solomon, later identified, threw three Molotovs, then pulled out what police labeled as a makeshift flamethrower, all within 45 seconds. And no one stopped him. No police. No security. Not even a siren. So I asked the obvious. Where were the police? A contact inside the city's emergency coordination center told me that Boulder PD had limited presence due to resource allocation. Translation: they'd diverted patrol units that day to a completely different event, a tech conference at the CU Boulder Engineering Quad. The conference's keynote sponsor? A company called Chrysalis Shield. The name didn't mean much at the time, but it would later become central to everything. The next day, the Boulder PD issued a vague statement identifying the suspect as Mohammed Solomon, 32, Egyptian-American, no criminal record, charged with over 100 counts. Hate crimes included. I started digging. Solomon was a former aerospace engineer, graduated from MIT. worked briefly with NASA. But what caught my attention was his 3-year employment gap from 2021 to 2024. No LinkedIn updates, no resumes, no conference attendance, just silence. So I traced his last known public post, a comment on a Reddit thread about predictive policing. It read, "The system isn't broken. It's designed to fail in ways you'll never trace back." That's when I knew. He didn't act alone. At the very least, he was protected. And I was about to learn just how far that protection extended. Predictive blindness. Boulder wasn't just quiet. It was sterile. Like the city was trying to erase the fact that a terrorist had turned one of its most iconic streets into a war zone. The local news regurgitated what little the police offered. There were no investigative questions. No press briefings. No accountability. I've been reporting long enough to know that when the silence is that coordinated, there's something bigger underneath. That's when I circled back to Chrysalis Shield. The name showed up twice. First, as a tech sponsor of the university's surveillance initiative. Second, and far more chilling, on an internal Boulder PD document labeled Operational Prioritization, Predictive Asset Deployment, week of May 27th to June 2nd. That was the week leading up to the firebombing. According to the document, leaked to me by a contact in municipal IT, Chrysalis Shield had advised local law enforcement to deprioritize real-time patrols at low-threat digital clusters, including the Run for Their Lives March. The justification? Minimal threat probability based on historical sentiment scores and behavioral trend metrics. In other words, a private tech firm with ties to city officials decided the protest wasn't dangerous enough to monitor. And Mohammed Solomon walked right through that blind spot with fire in his hands. I needed to understand who they were. Chrysalis Shield was founded in 2020, right after the George Floyd protests, by a pair of ex-MIT engineers and a defense contractor. On paper, they provide predictive threat intelligence software for municipalities seeking non-invasive risk mitigation. What that really means is, they use social media patterns, AI algorithms, and encrypted location metadata to tell police where crime might happen. But their data isn't public. Their methods aren't peer-reviewed. And their contracts are almost always no bid. The deeper I went, the darker it got. Chrysalis Shield had quietly embedded their software into Boulder PD's systems just 6 months before the attack. Part of a pilot program aimed at proving AI could do what human instinct once handled. Except it didn't. It failed. Or maybe it succeeded. Because that's the other thing. Mohammed Solomon once interned at Chrysalis Shield. That gap in his resume. I filled it. I found an archive company newsletter from January 2023, featuring a spotlight on their remote machine learning team. And there he was. Solomon, standing between two servers, grinning like any other coder, captioned as strategic simulation analyst. He'd helped them build the very algorithm that later deemed the protest too safe to patrol. And no one, not a single official, disclosed that link. But that's not even the worst of it. I met with a woman named Danica, who claimed to have been a junior developer at Chrysalis. She'd left the company in April, just weeks before the attack. We met at a truck stop outside Denver. She wouldn't go on record, but she did show me one thing, a screenshot from a Slack thread. The message was from a Chrysalis Shield exec. It read, "Red flag, Solomon's behavioral volatility score has spiked. Scrub from police sync until audit completes. Scrub from police sync." In other words, intentionally remove his data from the system feeding Boulder PD's threat profiles. The timestamp? May 28th. 4 days before the attack. I couldn't breathe. That wasn't just neglect. That was active, digital manipulation. Erasing a threat from the map. So I confronted Boulder PD. No cameras. Just a quiet sit-down with a deputy chief and a city attorney who never stopped watching me. I showed them the Slack thread. Their faces didn't flinch. But the deputy said something that chilled me to the core. We rely on the integrity of our tech partners. If there was an internal issue at Chrysalis, it's their responsibility to self-report. Not ours. Not ours. Tell that to the victim still recovering from third-degree burns. To the mother who threw herself over her child as the first Molotov shattered behind them. And still, no arrests beyond Solomon. No federal inquiry into Chrysalis Shield. No pause on predictive policing programs in Boulder or beyond. The cover-up wasn't just digital. It was institutional. And that's when I realized, this wasn't about one man with firebombs. This was about a system designed to forget the people it fails. Or worse, to never see them in the first place. The invisible evidence. I didn't sleep the night I got the Slack thread. Not because I was afraid, though I probably should have been, but because I couldn't stop replaying one question in my head. Who gave the order to scrub Solomon from the system? It wasn't a glitch. It wasn't oversight. That Slack message was precise. Scrub from police sync. Someone made that decision. Someone authorized it. And if Danica was telling the truth, there had to be more. I spent the next 72 hours chasing every breadcrumb. First, I confirmed the Slack message metadata through a forensics contact in San Jose. It checked out. Time-stamped. Untampered. Real. Next, I combed through Chrysalis Shield's archive developer notes, security policies, and API change logs. Hidden in the back end of a GitHub repository, buried under a commit labeled UI patch 0.4.8, I found a deleted access token associated with Solomon's account. It had been revoked on May 30th, 2 days before the attack. Just after the Slack message was sent, that token wasn't just his access badge. It was the digital key used to input or alter threat scores inside the predictive policing dashboard used by Boulder PD. He wasn't just a former intern. He still had access. And someone cut him off only after his behavioral volatility score spiked. So what exactly triggered that spike? I reached out to a second whistleblower, an anonymous cyberethics specialist who once advised city governments on AI oversight. We spoke through a voice scrambler. I'll never forget what they said. Solomon's score spiked because of a metadata overlap. He posted a now-deleted comment on an encrypted alt forum that triggered an extremist keyword cascade. But instead of escalating him to a threat queue, his name was flagged as a false positive, internally labeled as protected asset. Protected asset. Those words changed everything. I'd heard that term before. In counterintelligence circles, in whistleblower leaks about corporate surveillance, in the kinds of documents that never see daylight unless someone's risking their career or their life. It implied Solomon was more than just a rogue actor. It implied he was being shielded. I asked, why would a private company protect a man with that profile? The voice replied, because if he helped build the framework and they needed plausible deniability, it's easier to bury him after the fact than admit he was left in the system. Or worse, used as part of a simulation. You think this was a test run? I said. I think it was worse, they replied. I think it was a live calibration. That phrase kept me up for two more nights. A live calibration is when predictive software is exposed to a real-world crisis. Not to prevent it, but to learn from it. In certain tech circles, it's an open secret. Test the system's blind spots. See who gets through. Measure institutional response. Improve control later. If that's what happened here, if Solomon's attack was anticipated and allowed to proceed for data collection, we're not just talking about corruption. We're talking about conspiracy. So I went back to Boulder PD, this time with audio recordings, timestamp documents, and a legal contact on standby. They stonewalled me. The deputy chief said the city would be issuing no further comment due to ongoing federal review. The mayor's office declined an interview. The Chrysalis Shield website went into maintenance mode. Solomon's LinkedIn vanished. And yet, one voice refused to be silenced, Naomi. Remember her? The college organizer who survived the firebomb attack? She reached out to me directly, this time with something no one else had. Original footage from a secondary drone. Her group had launched a civilian drone for livestream coverage, not even realizing it had caught something the city drones didn't. She sent me the raw file. At timestamp 14 minutes and 38 seconds, you see Solomon walk through the alley behind the bookstore. But at timestamp 14 minutes and 52 seconds, another figure enters from the opposite side, wearing the same tactical vest, same boots, different gait, no firebomb, no weapons, just a handheld transmitter. Then, at 15 minutes and 7 seconds, the fire starts. The second man disappears behind a utility door before sirens ever arrive. There were two operatives on the ground. I ran the footage through facial analysis. The match was incomplete, partial obfuscation, but one result came back with a 73% probability. Leon Bryce, former intelligence liaison now contracted to, you guessed it, Chrysalis Shield. The connection was undeniable. But before I could release the footage, something happened. My press credential login was revoked. My encrypted server access glitched. My phone, a hardened burner I'd used for 5 years, rang once, then died permanently. Then, a single envelope was slipped under my hotel door. No return address. No message. Just a USB stick and a post-it note. You're not the only one watching. Drop it or disappear. I didn't drop it. I backed up the drone footage 10 times over. And now I'm preparing to release it through a neutral transparency channel. One that Chrysalis can't scrub, block, or override. Because whatever this was, hate crime, live calibration, corruption test, it was not isolated. It was coordinated. And if this system isn't stopped, the next Solomon won't be the last. Erased in real time. I've been followed before. Intimidated. Threatened. Silenced. But never erased. It started the moment I uploaded the drone footage to an encrypted cloud. One I'd used for 3 years without a single breach. At 3:12 a.m., I received a login alert from Singapore. For minutes later, the backup folder was gone. Not corrupted. Not moved. Just deleted. From the source drive and its mirror nodes. A ghost-level wipe. Then came the email. Spoofed address. Plaintext subject line. You made your choice. Attached was a screenshot. My hotel room, taken from the hallway. Time-stamped 90 minutes prior. The message was clear. They were inside. I checked out without turning on the lights. I left the key on the desk. No trace. I drove west out of Boulder with my gear in a backpack, my laptop in the trunk, and my voice recorder clipped under my bra strap. I didn't feel like a journalist anymore. I felt like a fugitive from a story I was trying to tell. But I wasn't about to let it go. Because every time I replayed that drone footage, I thought of Miriam, Naomi, the 16 people still recovering from third-degree burns. And I thought of the second man, the one no one was talking about, Leon Bryce. The name had only surfaced in defense contracting circles. Whispers, mostly. He wasn't listed on Chrysalis Shield's public payroll. But through a leak from an anonymous DOJ paralegal, I confirmed Bryce was once embedded in a domestic operations unit tasked with simulated response mapping, a classified project to test how cities respond to unforeseen digital era terror threats. His departure from government work, June 2024, 1 month before Chrysalis won the Boulder surveillance contract. I tracked his last known IP address to an office suite in downtown Denver. When I arrived, the building directory had no listing for Chrysalis Shield, but Suite 1708, the one tied to Bryce's activity, was locked, unmarked, and sealed with a biometric pad. No signage. No cameras. Just silence. I left a note under the door anyway. For words. I know about Boulder. That night, I booked a room under a fake name, logged into a secure signal relay, and connected with Naomi again. She had more. After the firebomb attack, Naomi had been contacted by what she assumed were federal agents. No names, just black SUVs and questions about communications from extremist channels. They took her phone, promised to return it after forensics. They never did. But Naomi, smart as ever, had something they didn't know about. Her drone software automatically uploaded copies to a separate microSD hidden in the controller's base. She hadn't checked it until now. When she did, she found a 4-second glitch clip that never made it into the original file. And in that clip, Bryce, full frontal shot, face uncovered, holding what appears to be a frequency jammer, not a weapon. Timestamp, 14 seconds before the first Molotov exploded. I examined the clip frame by frame. Behind Bryce, mounted to a pole, a city-owned surveillance unit, one of Boulder's smart eyes installed just 3 months prior. But here's what matters. At the exact second Bryce activated the device, the public surveillance unit flickered, and its data stream cut out. That camera's footage from 3:15 to 3:19 p.m. is missing from the city archives. It wasn't just a coincidence. It was a tactical blackout. So now we had motive, method, and suppression. But we still didn't have accountability. And worse, my press credentials had now been fully revoked by the National Journalists Federation, pending review for potential disinformation dissemination. My articles were pulled from syndication. 3 old tweets were flagged as manipulated content, even though they were screenshots of Boulder PD's own press statements. I was being erased, systematically. But the story wasn't dead. It was evolving, because someone, and I still don't know who, mailed me an envelope 2 days later. Inside, a photocopy of a Chrysalis Shield internal training slide titled Simulated Events, real outcomes. A redacted operations calendar dated June 1st, 2025, with only one item not blacked out. Live scenario calibration Boulder, Colorado Alpha Line, L. Bryce. It was no longer a question. This was never just Solomon. It was an authorized event, orchestrated, recorded, manipulated, and now covered up. The implications were national, maybe international. And as I sat on the motel floor with this new evidence spread around me, I realized something even more chilling. I'm not the only one they're trying to erase. Whistleblowers and ghost files. I couldn't go to the press. I was the press, and they'd already cut me out. By the time Chapter 4 unfolded, the blackout, the Bryce footage, the erased credentials, I knew the system was compromised far beyond law enforcement. What I hadn't expected was how quickly it reached the institutions meant to protect the truth. My email clients were disabled. My freelance accounts were flagged. Even independent editors I'd worked with for years suddenly went cold. Conflict of interest, pending legal review, cybersecurity concerns. One of them, a war-hardened producer I trusted, left me a voicemail. "Natalie, whatever you're chasing, stop. They're using national security to seal this. I've seen the order." It wasn't paranoia anymore. It was active suppression. I still had the drone footage, the Bryce frame, the leaked schedule. But to release it, I needed a channel they couldn't touch. That meant turning to the Graynet, a secure corridor of digital whistleblower platforms used by ex-intelligence operatives, rogue coders, and truth seekers with nothing left to lose. I reached out to Fireline, a decentralized transparency hub built after the Snowden leaks. It took 3 days to establish contact. I had to prove I wasn't bait, send biometric proof, verify metadata, confirm location history. Finally, a response. "We know about Bryce. Send everything. We'll package, mirror, and distribute across 26 global nodes." But just as I was preparing the upload, my signal dropped. My VPN stalled. Then, the motel router caught fire. Not an overload. A targeted thermal burst, likely triggered by remote signal triangulation. The motel owner didn't ask questions. He'd seen too much in his years off I-25. He tossed me a flashlight and said one thing. "You didn't burn that. You were burned." I left that night on foot, hiked 2 miles north, borrowed a library computer under a false login, and finally, uploaded the Bryce blackout clip, the Chrysalis slide, and the redacted schedule to Fireline using triple-mirrored encryption. They received it. They published it. And within 14 minutes, the node went dark. Someone killed the leak. I wasn't just dealing with corporate cleanup. I was up against a federal-level suppression protocol, meaning Bryce and Solomon weren't just pawns. They were calibrated assets in a national test that the government couldn't afford to expose. But then came the twist. A former DHS cybersecurity consultant, I'll call him Isaiah, reached out via voice-only relay. He had access to sealed reports. He wanted to talk. We met in a farmer's storage shed outside Longmont, surrounded by hay bales and broken tools. He brought printouts, government seals, timestamped briefings. He looked like a mechanic, spoke like a strategist. What he showed me left me frozen. A Homeland Security memo dated March 15, 2025, titled "Urban Contingency Simulations, Behavioral Extremes Under Political Polarization." Listed test cities included Baltimore, Seattle, Sacramento, and Boulder. The scenario: controlled exposure to a politically charged mass casualty event involving religious identifiers and predictive surveillance optics. Target group: Zionist identifying protest participants. Threat profile: digitally neutralized known actor, DNK. Risk index: acceptable collateral range, less than or equal to 20 casualties. I looked at Isaiah. "You're telling me they knew?" He nodded. "They built the scenario around the blowback. They weren't preventing it. They were studying it." I sat there shaking. All the survivors. The injuries. The trauma. Collateral. Isaiah left me with one more file. A sealed briefing from just 2 weeks ago. Public narrative risk assessment. It warned that if the Boulder operation was exposed as federally sanctioned simulation, it could result in widespread public distrust, rise in anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim violence, congressional hearings, suspension of predictive policing contracts nationwide. That's when it hit me. This wasn't about safety. It was about data, control, testing pain at scale. Naomi texted me that night. Simple words. "I'm scared. They're asking for my silence. I told her the truth. Me too. But if we stop now, it happens again. I knew the moment was coming. Expose everything, or disappear. But before I could act, someone else moved first. The insider. I got the message at 3:47 a.m. No sender. No signature. Just a location pin, dropped anonymously through the same encrypted backchannel I used for whistleblower uploads. It was a private residence. Not an office, not a warehouse, but a house, tucked into a tree-lined cul-de-sac just outside Louisville, Colorado. A place that looked like it belonged to a dentist or a stay-at-home novelist. Ordinary. Safe. It wasn't. I was told to come alone. No camera. No recorder. Just a burner phone. They said, someone on the inside is ready to talk. The real inside. I drove there just before dawn. Fog hung low on the fields like something holding its breath. And when I pulled up, I saw her standing in the doorway. A woman in her early 50s, short silver hair, wearing a NASA windbreaker. She didn't give me her name, but I already knew it. Dr. Elise Darien, lead architect of Chrysalis Shield's predictive engine, Solomon's former supervisor. The moment I stepped inside, she locked the door and pulled the curtains. No small talk, no formalities, just one line. They're going to destroy both of us, but I can't carry this anymore. She led me to a dining table covered in folders, printouts, and hard drives. And then, for the next 2 hours, she unraveled everything. According to Darien, Solomon was never a fringe threat. He was a calculated prototype, part of a behavioral modeling initiative codenamed Project Scarlet, funded not just by Chrysalis Shield, but co-sponsored by a sub-branch of Homeland Security specializing in emergent chaos simulations. He wasn't just an engineer. He was the simulation itself. Solomon's behavioral volatility wasn't a bug in the system. It was a controlled evolution, monitored, managed, and permitted to escalate within predicted limits. We designed the model to learn in real time, she said. But someone higher than us decided to let it play out physically. I protested. I submitted risk reports. They blacked them out. I asked her why she was talking to me now. She looked straight at me, because I saw the look on his face. Solomon wasn't radicalized by hate groups. He was radicalized by us, by the data loop. We fed his delusions to see what would happen. She handed me a thumb drive. Encrypted. Password protected. She said it contained full logs from Project Scarlet. Threat score manipulation, Bryce's handler logs, internal Chrysalis BD communications, and a 27-minute audio recording from a risk management meeting held 3 weeks before the Boulder attack. She played me a clip. A voice I recognized immediately. Leon Bryce. If this gets out of hand, we ghost the source, isolate the PD, and spin it as lone wolf extremism. No ties, no trail. Blame online radicalization. Scrub predictive history. Understood. Every person in the room agreed. Then she said the part that made my blood turn to ice. They used to tell us that simulation was safe, that no one would get hurt. But the moment Bryce said the word acceptable casualties, I knew we'd crossed a line we'd never come back from. She begged me to leak the files in stages, to control the drop, not dump it all at once. Because if everything came out in one burst, the federal government would invoke National Security Directive 58A, a protocol that allows them to seal all materials related to cyberterrorism simulations under emergency classification, regardless of media protection. That meant if I moved too fast, I'd lose it all. She also warned me. They're not just tracking servers. They're watching you. They've tagged your voice, your gait, your location patterns. You're now a moving signature. We didn't hug, didn't cry, just stood there, watching the sun bleed through the blinds. Before I left, I asked her the final question. Was the Boulder attack preventable? She whispered. It was designed to be preventable. That's the horror. I drove 6 hours west, switched vehicles, and uploaded the first file drop to 3 overseas transparency networks. Within 20 minutes, 300,000 downloads. By morning, the name Project Scarlet was trending globally. And Bryce vanished. No subpoena. No charges. No photo. Just disappeared like a shadow that was never meant to be seen. That night, someone broke into Darien's house. She survived. But everything inside was gone. She's now under protective watch. Anonymous. Exiled from the tech world she helped create. And I'm alone again. But I still have the rest of the files. And the final audio, the one that proves government complicity, is ready for release. the story's no longer just about a firebomb in Boulder. It's about how far a country will go to stage pain in the name of control. The final tape. The tape wasn't supposed to exist. That's what Dr. Elise Darien had told me before she handed me the drive. They recorded it for internal calibration. They never meant to archive it, but someone had, and now I held it in my hand. The 27-minute audio file captured a closed-door meeting between top Chrysalis Shield executives, Homeland Security consultants, and one individual, unknown at the time, listed in the file metadata only as Operator Z. We'd come to know him later, but I'll get to that. The first voice on the recording is Bryce. Clear, confident, calm. He lays out what sounds less like a briefing and more like a battle plan. June 1st, 1500 hours. Pearl Street Corridor. Estimated crowd size, 200. Operator embedded. Threat profile authorized. PD removed from direct oversight. Objective: observe socio-political response to rapid-fire hate crime escalation within a localized, liberal-controlled municipality. Then another voice cuts in, distorted slightly, like it's being masked. And what of post-impact containment? Bryce responds, local law enforcement will follow media protocol. We direct the narrative through influencer pipelines. Tag protesters as disruptive extremists. Reinforce digital trail pointing to known radicalized user clusters. The masked voice. Survivor casualties? Bryce. Projecting 12 to 18 injuries. Fatalities unlikely with current timeline. Risk window remains acceptable. 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 That word echoed in my ears for days. As if the pain endured by 16 people was just a bullet point in someone's quarterly performance review. But it was the last part of the tape that changed everything. A third voice enters, calm and amused. Not distorted. Not Bryce. It belonged to a man who said just one line. Let it burn. What we learn from fire, we cannot learn from data alone. Then the recording ends. No names. No closing. Just static. I matched the voice, grainy, but distinct, against a digital signature library provided by Fireline's European node. The closest match? Wesley Crane, a federal surveillance architect. Former DC policymaker, known for advising predictive counterterrorism protocols during the Snowden era. He'd all but vanished from the public eye in 2022, quietly entering the private sector under a firm registered in the Caymans. The firm, Operis Global Systems, a silent investor in Chrysalis Shield. This wasn't a fluke. It was a network. Crane helped design the simulation. Bryce ran the field ops. Solomon was the fuse. And Boulder, a progressive city with deep divisions and high-profile protests, was the perfect laboratory. I uploaded the full tape to three whistleblower chains. Fireline, Obsidian, Deepcast. By dawn, two of the sites were dark. The third had been hijacked, replaced with a blank screen that read, redacted by order of National Cybersecurity Enforcement Act, Code 71A. They were invoking Code 71A, a legal provision that allows federal authorities to seize and silence digital content deemed a threat to national psychological cohesion. I didn't even know such a law existed. Most people didn't. It passed quietly during a defense budget vote in late 2023. But the tape had already spread. Someone had mirrored it. Within 12 hours, the hashtags #ScarletProtocol, #LetItBurn, and #BoulderCoverUp were trending globally. Then the retaliation began. My bank account was frozen, pending security verification. My apartment in DC? Raided, under a federal search warrant for terrorist communications. They found nothing, because I had burned everything. But Naomi was taken. She was pulled into protective custody for her own safety after a DHS visit to her campus. No one, not her professors, not even her parents, were told where she was taken. I only found out because she sent me one last message through a secret student forum. It read, "They said it's for my protection, but they're wiping me. Please don't let them." I won't. I'm recording this now from a cabin outside the country. The signal's shaky, the battery's low, and I've rerouted my data path through five blacklisted servers. But I'm still here, because this story is not over. The Boulder firebomb attack wasn't the work of a madman. It was the intentional ignition of a data-fueled experiment. A new kind of war. Digital. Predictive. Psychological. And the flames are spreading. Reckoning in the ashes. The fire was never about flames. It was about control. By the time the tape reached over 5 million downloads, the story had already slipped beyond the reach of any kill switch. From Berlin to Sao Paulo, newscasters played distorted segments of the Bryce recording. Protests erupted outside tech firms in DC, San Francisco, and even Boulder itself. The city I once called a laboratory of silence was now a megaphone of defiance. But the US government didn't apologize. It retaliated. Within 24 hours of the viral drop, the Department of Justice issued a federal gag order on all active media related to unauthorized cyber leaks affecting national cohesion. Reporters were summoned, servers were wiped, and a revised narrative was released. The Boulder firebombing was the work of a radicalized individual influenced by foreign propaganda and domestic extremism. Predictive surveillance did not fail. It was circumvented. Circumvented. That word stuck with me like ash in my lungs. Meanwhile, Naomi's whereabouts remained sealed under protective custody. Her lawyer, one of the few willing to speak off record, told me she was being held at a facility near Cheyenne, Wyoming. Not a jail. Not a hospital. Something in between. A rehabilitation site for extremism disinformation exposure, run by a private contractor with no public oversight. The name, Trinity Civic Systems, another shell company linked to Operis Global. The Hydra had many heads, but cracks had formed. Survivors from the Boulder attack began speaking out, some anonymously, others defiantly. One victim, Elias Bloom, a 29-year-old musician who suffered third-degree burns on both arms, gave a public interview that shattered the federal narrative. He held up his phone, scorched and half-melted, and said, "This phone recorded the attack. It also recorded what happened after, when the man in tactical gear walked away calmly and got into a van with government plates. That clip hit harder than any leak I ever uploaded." Within hours, three members of Congress demanded a closed-door hearing on the federal use of predictive terror simulation. It wasn't enough, but it was something. The reckoning didn't come in the form of justice. It came in the form of exposure. And that sometimes is the most dangerous weapon of all. I resurfaced 1 month later. I gave one live interview to a neutral international outlet. No makeup, no script, just a microphone and the raw truth. I looked straight into the lens and said, "The Boulder firebomb attack was not an accident. It was data warfare disguised as public safety. It was a psychological operation dressed as a hate crime. And it's not the last." The backlash was instant. Commentators labeled me a traitor. Pundits called it fiction. But others, students, whistleblowers, survivors, started their own channels. Project Scarlet was trending again, this time with a new suffix. Hashtag never again is now. Chrysalis Shield quietly dissolved 6 weeks later. Operis Global restructured under a new shell. Bryce was never found. Crane was declared dead. Heart failure in a private villa outside Nice, France. No autopsy. And Naomi? She was eventually released, but with a sealed non-disclosure agreement and a 6-month travel ban. She now teaches digital ethics at a small college in Vermont. She doesn't speak publicly, but sometimes she sends me a photo of the sky. And me. I keep telling stories. Quietly. Carefully. Because someone has to. The Boulder firebomb left scars on skin, cities, and systems. But it also sparked something else. A refusal to stay blind. A hunger to question what we're told. A fight to see through smoke and tell the truth from inside the fire. This is Natalie Reyes. And this was the story they tried to erase. But fire has a memory. And now so do you.